The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Patrick O'Flynn, political commentator regularly for Coffee House and former UKIP MEP. Now, this is the week that the Brexit Party officially changed its name to Reform UK, and this heralds a new chapter for Nigel Farage with the party, where he plans to campaign for changes to the voting system, the House of Lords, the BBC and various other institutions. So, is this a Nigel Farage comeback? Are we about to see a new force in UK politics that's going to shake things up in the way the Brexit Party did? Or is there not going to be so much a bang as a whimper? Patrick, you've written about this on Coffee House. How do you think this party, perhaps it's a new party, it's a reformed version of a party, is going to change the UK political landscape?
Well, I think it's not a bad brand name to have at the moment. Obviously the Brexit Party was redundant brand, rendered completely obsolete when even Nigel Farage had to admit Boris Johnson had honoured the guts of Brexit. So reform, no one could say this country is in a position where we don't need reform. It's modern sounding and it's moderate. But then again, it's the permission to use the name, which I think is a slight turn up for the books, because I think they were thinking they were going to get turned down. It's arrived at a slightly awkward time for Nigel in particular. Because if you look at what's happening across in Washington, with his what might be viewed as his political, kinfolk, that doesn't look like any kind of reform, does it? And I think it's a tricky one for Nigel, and the downsides of his friendship with Trump are suddenly magnified. And very quickly, there's a couple of other things which aren't quite in alignment either. Lockdown angst is perhaps less than it was when the second lockdown was declared, because we have the new strain. I think everyone can see the strain on hospitals, and we have vaccine rollout, so there's an exit strategy too. So there are probably 10 to 15% of the electorate very strongly opposed to lockdown, but I think that's narrowed somewhat, so that's not ideal for Nigel either. Apart from that, though, there's plenty to go at in the medium term. But I think the trickiest thing is to distance himself from Trump and not contaminate his brand, which is supposed to be, after all, more modern looking, outward and potentially appealing to more people.
James, do you think the Tories are worried about this new venture? Do you get that sense from government or even Tory MPs?
I don't think they are at the moment, although, as Patrick points out in his blog, underestimating Nigel Farage is a kind of fool's game. But I think the reasons are this. The real way back in for Farage was a sellout, in inverted commas, on Brexit, particularly on anything around free movement. There isn't that. And as Patrick says, because Nigel Farage has essentially accepted the deal is pretty much, is Brexit, I don't think he has that way in. And then I think on China, I think this government is going to be hawkish enough to deal with that kind of public desire. You talk to pollsters, there is now a public appetite for a tougher line on China. But I think because China is an issue that knits together the Tory coalition, if you want to see a kind of industrial renaissance, manufacturing renaissance in Britain, you need to take a tougher line on China, intellectual property theft and the like. If you're a more Cameroon type of Tory, you're worried about human rights, Tibet, the wet markets, all those kind of things. So I think you will see the Tories take a tough enough line on China, but there isn't a space there for Nigel Farage, which then leaves the kind of issues like the BBC and these other kind of cultural questions. And again, I just don't think those animate voters in sufficiently large numbers. Now, I think the big question here is, can the government demonstrate competence? If they can, roll out the vaccine and get life back to normal, around April, May time, then I think that they will avoid the kind of the bad midterm blues that they could have if they don't do that. And I think it's also obviously the question as well is, can you deal with those basic hygiene issues for the Tory party, like crime, for example? And I think if they can do that, they can deny Nigel Farage that space. I think it is hard to see what the rallying cry is now, given that Brexit has been done.
Well, if I could leap in there, I think there are a few issues, and you know, Nigel's very talented at feeling the heat of the issue as it arises. I think there'll be a challenge from Nigel Farage and Richard Tice around economic policy from the spring onwards, particularly taxation, where they'll push the idea of dynamic, you know, Reaganite magic tax cuts that bring you more money. Now, there's a big slab of Tory support which will find that idea very appealing in quite simplistic terms. I mean, I'm someone who believes that only sometimes works, you know, and sometimes you might cut taxes and end up with an even bigger deficit. But nonetheless, part of the Tory tribe, maybe particularly the small business vote, will respond to that. I think the green issues and the amount of public money being spent on the green issues is, again, there's certainly a niche of right-wing voters that are very fed up with that. And I don't think Boris Johnson is going to soft pedal that very much. And then there's always the issue of the reality of immigration rather than the sort of conceptual talk about points-based immigration policy. So I think he's got quite a lot to go at. And I do think that with Tice particularly, there will be a focus on small state, light touch regulation, dynamic tax cuts, and some of the Tory vote and the business vote will find that potentially appealing. And remember, they only need to take a small percentage off the Tories before the Conservative Party is behind in the polls. And then that stresses and tests the esprit de corps of Tory MPs, which is by no means always impregnable.
Patrick, how do you think that the party is going to manifest itself, I suppose, get airtime, be noticed? Because lots of people know what the Brexit Party is. I suspect not many people know what Reform is yet. They don't have any representation in Parliament. It's not a problem that has stopped Nigel Farage in the past. But what do you think the strategy is for almost getting their voice heard or being part of the debates on some of the issues that you've mentioned?
Well, I think they'll certainly use Nigel's social media platform, which is pretty big. I think, funnily enough, they'll also hope for a little opening among some of the centre-left anti-Boris media, who might cotton on that if they treat this new entity with their heads rather than their hearts, every point they can give it in the opinion polls is probably a point off the Tory score. So oddly enough, they might be sort of skirting around the Guardian and centre-left outlets and some of the more trendier broadcasters for coverage. And it will be interesting to see if any of the broadcasters play that game.
I think there's a problem here, though, for Nigel Farage. He's a victim of his own success because UKIP got going because of the European Parliament elections. The proportional system meant they could get MPs elected on 5% of the vote in a particular region. Once you've got an MEP, you've got someone to send on TV, who the broadcasters are obliged to have on at various points in the electoral cycle, and you get resources, funding and standing. Given that we have a first-past-the-post system, I don't see where Reform are likely to win a parliamentary seat. And I also struggle to see the kind of council that they're likely to win. And I think it's interesting what Patrick was saying about Richard Tice and, you know, Reaganite tax cuts and the like. And I can undoubtedly see that is going to have an appeal to a certain type of Tory voter. But if you look at the places where UKIP actually came and the Brexit Party came closest to winning MPs, I don't think those are the kind of constituencies where people are crying out for lower levels of capital gains tax or lower levels of corporation tax. I suspect that their economics are a little bit more like Patrick's, a bit more social democrat rather than small state libertarian. And I think this is going to be a challenge for them, which is, you know, I can see, and undoubtedly because the books are going to have to be balanced after COVID, you know, I can see that there is going to be a set of irritated businessmen who you might be able to appeal to, you know, who haven't liked lockdown. Think of kind of people like Rocco Forte, for example, you know, who feel that their businesses have really suffered and will not like the idea that there should be higher taxes to try and help balance the books afterwards. But again, I don't see that lining up with where the Farage brand has actually proved most effective. You know, I don't think that, you know, up in Grimsby, for example, that is where you are going to, you know, you're going to see people rallying to that kind of political call.
Patrick, do you think the aim here is for seats at the next election, or is it actually to be an influential voice, not necessarily meaning seats, but if you have that place where you are denting the Tory lead, making it so they don't think they can go into another election, you can change stances on policy and so forth.
Well, I think with Richard Tice's view, I interviewed him for Coffee House before Christmas, and he very much, I think, now is in it for the next few years and hoping to build towards some kind of challenge in target seats at the next election. With Nigel, you know, he tends to blow hotter and colder and we can't tell. But I do agree with some of what James has said. And I think, therefore, this year's round of elections, should they take place, possibly in June rather than in May, where you do have proportional representation elections for the devolved assemblies for Scotland, Wales and London, that's all quite important for this party. And I particularly would say London, where after all, last time round in London, UKIP got two members of the Greater London Assembly. And I think potentially Richard Tice could stand for mayor for Reform UK and use the publicity around that to push a vote share, which would potentially land them with a couple of assembly members, which would be a start. I think in Wales, they might have prospects too, although, as James was alluding to, that's somewhere you would need a more blue-collar type message. Scotland, I'm told, they're looking at and may surprise us, but I don't know quite in what direction, because traditionally UKIP didn't do well at all in Scotland. Certainly, Brexit Party was a little bit stronger in Scotland, but overall, Scotland's proven to be pretty Farage resistant.
James, where do you think Reform can do well? What areas? You mentioned the fact that there might be a disconnect between what funders might want and what perhaps the target audience or the audience that would be perhaps the easiest to win round. Do you think cultural issues could be something? We've seen that there have been Tory MPs who are quite keen for Boris Johnson to take a tougher stance on culture wars, and he doesn't move as far as some want. So do you think that's somewhere that Nigel Farage could capitalise?
I've long thought that if you look at kind of polling on public opinion, that the gap in the political marketplace is for a socially conservative but economically Keynesian party. That is the kind of unserved bit of politics right now. Now, I think that space has become a little bit harder because Keir Starmer is trying to avoid Labour getting drawn into kind of cultural war issues. You know, he is, to adapt Mary, David Cameron's mother, you know, he is someone who does his tie up and stands up and sings the national anthem. You know, you can't keep Keir Starmer away from the Union Jack at the moment. But that is the space. Now, and I think there's an interesting thing. I mean, Nigel Farage actually demonstrated that he had quite a bit of appeal to those kind of voters. But if, as Patrick says, Richard Tice wants to make this into a cut regulation, cut taxes party, then I think that's much more trying to win over kind of the kind of classic Tory heartlands in the southeast. And I think that is going to be a hard stretch. I think one of the things that Nigel Farage went on his political journey was, you know, he realised that, you know, that they could easily pick up votes in the home counties and Hampshire and places like that. But it was very hard for them to do well enough to win because they're not going to get 30 to 40% of a vote in a constituency. They need both Labour and the Tories to be competitive in that place to win, and preferably the Lib Dems or the Nationalists or somebody else too, so that you can win with 30% of the vote rather than having to get 40% of the vote to win. I think that is the problem for them, that I think they are going to have to shift on economics if they are going to be competitive in those places in what we like to call the Red Wall.
And Patrick, just to give the final word to you, what do you say to that? Do you agree with what James is saying in terms of that economic message?
Well, I think there may be ways around that. There may be ways to sort of talk about public sector waste and able to kind of channel resources into the front line, which may strike a chord with large numbers of voters, particularly older voters, even if, you know, we who are kind of more in the system have heard that all before and know it's a lot harder than it sounds to cut out this so-called flab and waste, which is something, you know, the Tories going back to Michael Howard and before that have tried to kind of add their sums up on. But I don't think it's impossible. Again, this is a party which can change the game vis-a-vis the Tory Labour race just by taking 5 or 6 points off the Tories and then aim to get its own representation at relatively low turnout PR type elections. And then there's always the issue of immigration, where for more than a decade running, the Conservatives promised net migration below 100,000 and never delivered it. And now Boris is kind of backed away from that. But are either natural Tories or Red Wall voters really going to allow him to back away from that? And I do think, again, with chaotic scenes in the Channel, it's the issue Nigel knows and knows how to kind of lever best. And looking ahead to a tricky midterm with a hole blown in the economy, again, the opportunist Farage will scent where the government is in trouble. So medium term, I do think he'll have a little whirl.
Don't underestimate Nigel Farage, as Patrick says. I think that the immigration question, there is a trickiness here for Nigel Farage. He wants to portray himself as Mr. Tough on China. I think the big immigration story of later this year and next year is going to be the number of people coming from Hong Kong to live in Britain. How does he approach that issue? You know, I think if you look at the number of people applying for British national overseas passports, you are going to have very substantial numbers of people coming from Hong Kong to here. I don't see how you square a tough line on China, the Chinese communist dictatorship is the biggest threat to world peace with, oh, but we're not going to take people from Hong Kong. And if he's going to take people from Hong Kong, he's going to be pro the biggest, what I think will be the biggest migration flow into the UK over the next 2 years or so.
Well, I agree with that. And I do expect Nigel to be pro Hong Kong immigration. I think he's kind of hinted at that before. And I think that's a perfectly perceptive, you know, big hole. Maybe out in the Red Wall, they won't be quite so sympathetic to that.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.